Welcome to the FDF Podcast, passionate about food and drink.
Hello, this is Ian Wright, the Chief Executive of the Food and Drink Federation. Welcome to our podcast, Passionate About Food and Drink. This week, we're taking a slightly different tack. In the past, this podcast has normally featured my friend and colleague, Tim Rycroft, asking me questions about what I think is happening in the world of food and drink. This week, the roles are reversed for the very good reason that this is Tim's last podcast with the FDF. And in fact, it's almost his last day with the FDF. And I thought it would be interesting to reflect on the 5-year journey that we've taken together in developing the modern offering of the FDF, in particular over the last 2 or 3 years as the organisation has battled with the twin crises of Brexit and COVID-19, but also looking perhaps with a longer perspective or a wider perspective at some of the other events of the last 5 years and some of the things that we've achieved, and to hear Tim's reflections on what the organisation might do next. And Tim's in an unusual position in this regard, because as well as having been the most senior person in the FDF over the last 5 years, he's moving on to an even more important role as Chief Executive of the Agricultural and Horticultural Development Board, a critical part of the national food infrastructure and a hugely influential role in the way in which the government's national food policy, national food strategy will develop. So, Tim, welcome.
Thank you, Ian, for that very kind introduction. A 5-year journey makes us sound a bit like Star Trek, and we certainly have encountered some strange new worlds and strange new civilizations along the way.
Well, and I'm really hoping that after this you will live long and prosper.
How kind.
Let's start by just trying to remember what life was like when you joined in at the end of 2015. I mean, going back that far, we were in the first few months of the first Conservative majority government. Barack Obama was still president of the US. The global economy was doing reasonably well in the backwash 5 years, 6 years earlier of the global financial crisis. And Jurgen Klopp had not yet arrived at Liverpool. It seems like it was a very different world to me. Do you remember it the same?
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, we, of course, had worked together at Diageo a few years previously, and you had joined FDF 6 months or so before I did. And you're right that it seems now that it was a curious kind of calm before the storm. Although at that time, we did, of course, know that a Brexit referendum was coming, though I don't think any of us had any idea quite what the consequences of that would be, both for the country and for FDF as an organisation, because, of course, that came to be, at least until the arrival of COVID-19, that was absolutely the dominant narrative to which the organisation had to respond.
Yeah, and I think also I would say that although food and drink has been throughout the last 10, 15, 20 years an absolutely central feature of the national conversation, and in particular the Brits' obsession with food and drink has been reflected in a kind of almost continuous diet of television and radio programs about the subject, I don't think it had become quite as politicized as it is now. And I think we should take some credit for that, for making it an issue of national policy. But I wonder if you think that, I wonder what you think were the things that were going to happen obvious, or is the way in which the national debate on food and drink has taken place, is that solely really a function of the unexpected consequences of Brexit?
No, I don't think solely that. I think we both came into this organisation with a background in corporate affairs and communications, and even by the time I arrived, you had already set out a very clear course that this was an organisation which was going to engage much more actively in the external policy environment, And it was an organisation that was going to take a point of view on things. And both of those things distinguished it from how FDF had been before you arrived. So while it's certainly true that Brexit and COVID have put a spotlight on food and drink, the fact is that even before that, you had embarked us on a course, which I was, of course, very comfortable with, that we would be an organisation that really cared about our reputation with external stakeholders, that we wanted to be credible and authoritative and admired, even by those who didn't necessarily agree with us. And that was occasionally quite a tough position to take, but I think it really began to bear fruit quite quickly.
Do you think that the panoply of non-governmental organisations, by which I really mean pressure groups in this field, is that an advantage for us in that we have the opportunity to be a counterpoint to them? Or is it a disadvantage because those sorts of groups over the last 5 years have to a greater or lesser degree, outside Brexit and COVID, been able to make the weather, to frame the debate?
One of the things that I think we both struggled with in the early days was having come from beverage alcohol, which is a pretty highly consolidated industry sector with a relatively small number of big players dominating the market. Coming into food and drink was a whole different world, much less consolidated, much more in some ways fragmented, and historically having found it very hard to speak with one voice, even across manufacturing and certainly across the whole of the food chain. So that was that was certainly a handicap. And I think, again, one of the things that you set out very early was the importance of us acting as a convener of the industry, as a hub for industry views, as a catalyst for the industry to speak more often with a single voice. And that was definitely helpful. I think it's true, though, that the NGOs, the campaigning charities, I mean, particularly, of course, on the issue of obesity, have enjoyed significant success in influencing government policy in that area throughout the 5 years in which we've been here. I think that we stood out, I hope, as a credible and a very straight voice on that issue. I think we have tried to be factual and as objective as our position allows to defend the interests of our members, but also to engage with an issue that we think is very important for the country and something that matters to all of us. And I guess one of my frustrations, regrets, as I look back over the 5 years, is that I don't think we've made as much progress on that agenda as I would have wished.
But I was going to ask you about that. I mean, I think we would both agree that the one area where we haven't managed to bring the industry together and with us has been on an active program on obesity. We've had three or four goes, and we've had some very innovative and different ideas, including the famous big generous offer we made to the Cameron government very early on, an offer incidentally to which they still haven't responded, perhaps got lost in the post with Mr. Cameron's shares for Greensill. Do you think that is actually a function of the fragmentation of the industry? I mean, my sense is perfectly legitimately that our members, and particularly our really biggest members, the blue chip members that we have, and we're very privileged to represent, often have really quite complex market positions, which mean that particularly on the issue of advertising versus promotional policy, they'll have one set of brands where they want to defend the right to advertise, but they'll have another set of brands where actually the promotional mechanics are more important, and trying to reconcile those priorities is extremely difficult for them. As a consequence, impossible for us.
Yes, I think one of the ingredients of our success at FDF is that we both came from a very corporate background, and we both had experience of dealing with industry trade associations. And those two things have guided us. I think that the first has given us a kind of commercial awareness of the way in which companies approach these issues and the kinds of the mindsets around your product portfolio, your marketing and promotional strategy, the way in which you seek commercial advantage from the regulatory environment, however you find it. Our understanding of that, I think, has been very helpful. And also our understanding of, I mean, I often used to say that, you know, we know what a bad trade association looks like, therefore we should be able to build a good one. And I do think, although that's a little bit glib, I think there was some of that going on, that we had both experienced what it was like to be members of trade associations that weren't delivering for us. And that helped guide us towards a different path. And I think you're right that on the diet, health and obesity issue, there's a huge amount of good work going on by companies who are almost without exception strongly engaged on that issue, but different kinds of work in different kinds of areas. Some of them are very engaged in promoting physical activity. Some of them are very engaged in reformulation and changing product sizes. Some of them are focused on changing their marketing. And it's just been very difficult, I think, to find a kind of sweet spot to which they would all feel comfortable, both acknowledge what they're already doing and potentially took it further.
So you might argue that actually COVID and Brexit are untypical, because as issues, they broadly have left the industry in one single position. Industry has reacted to COVID pretty much as one group of with one position. And with the EU exit, although some members perfectly reasonably took a position of being in favour of the exit, usually for commercial reasons, the majority of members would have preferred not to exit because of all the upset and difficulty and increased bureaucracy and huge amounts of costs that we're seeing visited on the industry now. In those circumstances, it's much easier for trade associations to be the voice of the industry. When you get to complex policy issues, it's more difficult. Some people, Henry Dimbleby, for example, would say that the role of the trade associations is essentially to be a conservative voice, to be the lowest common denominator in an industry debate. Do you think that's fair?
I think that is sometimes true of trade associations. I think we have developed a more sophisticated view of our role. So yes, occasionally that has been what we are for. Quite often what we are for is to say the things that our members don't wish to say publicly. Mm. And having a trade association allows you, if you like, to ride two different horses. So your corporate position in public can be something that is more comfortable, more aligned with your own corporate position. But through your trade association, you can nonetheless articulate and support perhaps a tougher position on regulation. And we've seen that pretty consistently over the last 5 years, where that has been our role. And we have been very active in resisting some of the regulation around obesity on behalf of members. Always, I'd like to think, in a factual and objective way. We've always engaged with issues, not people. We've always engaged on the evidence. We've always tried to make the case about the broader impact on this industry, because too often we see individual government departments taking a single department view of food and drink rather than a holistic view. So yes, I think the role of the trade association is broader than the one that Henry has identified. And in the final analysis, you can't run a successful trade association if you're significantly or consistently out of sync with your members' views. I think if you are effective and you can build up a well of credibility with members, then they will give you some forgiveness if you're saying things they disagree with. But I think if that becomes a consistent pattern, or if they feel that you are egregiously out of line with their position, in the end, they won't continue to fund you. So one of the things that I think we've done quite well is staying close enough to members to feel a good judgment about where the critical mass of member sentiment is,
Do you think, that's a challenge you might very well face at AHDB in the next few months, of course. What do you think the biggest single issue we've faced has been, and what do you think our biggest challenge is for the future?
Well, the issue that I think back on as having taxed me most intensely was definitely the period of Brexit, when the government was in most turmoil, when Theresa May was trying to get her deal through, when we had the meaningful votes and we had the indicative votes, and the political turmoil was intense, and we were trying to stay a high profile voice in that conversation, but to avoid taking a position which could be interpreted as party political. And that was a high wire act, and it was happening daily. You know, I remember for quite some time that there would be daily changes of policy and positioning, and I just remember that being an exhausting time, in some ways an exhilarating time, because we were very much in the spotlight, and food and drink was pretty well established then as kind of the poster child of the impacts of the different kinds of Brexit that were then being considered. And I was very proud of our team, because everybody here worked very intensely through that period, and we carried members with us. And I don't recall us significantly putting a foot wrong.
So in a way, this last few months has been almost the direct opposite of that period, in that Brexit, EU exit, transition period, so on, has completely dropped out of the headlines. And it yesterday I heard a very senior civil servant say that we'd turned the corner on the EU exit, and it struck me that we'd turned the corner into the abyss. But we are in a period where exports are down 75%. The government has basically walked away from trying to impose import, not restrictions, but documentation, because he just knows he couldn't do it, wouldn't be ready. At some point, there must be a reckoning to all of this, because the import documentation can't be suspended forever. The idea that because a product was safe yesterday, it'll be safe today is fine, but when it was safe a year ago and it might not be safe tomorrow, it's a bit different. How do you see those issues? Will they come back into the public mind, or are we going to have to continue to fight these concerns and represent the industry in a debate which is actually not going on in public?
Yes, it's a curious kind of phony war going on now, isn't it, about Brexit, because we're hearing from members still all the time about the issues they're facing as a consequence of the new trading arrangements. And yet, as you say, it's very much less visible in the media. One does get the sense that this government, for perfectly understandable reasons, is trying to manage very much in the moment, is managing from week to week under the kind of extraordinary pressure they're under, the unprecedented circumstances. And it's hard to know how some of this more medium and long-term stuff plays out, because there clearly will be medium and long-term consequences of our trading relationship with Europe, as there will be medium and long-term consequences of COVID-19. And I suppose I have a huge amount of sympathy for the government in one sense, because all they can do really is try and do their best by the situation they face at the current moment. But some of that, some of the stuff that isn't being addressed, nonetheless, isn't going away. I suppose the other observation I would have on that is everybody would love to move to a world where we could spend more time talking about our net zero ambition and skills and automation and the adoption of artificial intelligence to make food and drink manufacturing more productive, and all of that stuff that has kind of been pushed onto the back burner now for 3 years, which, you know, nonetheless, which the industry is really keen to talk about and has a great story to tell. And it's kind of quite frustrating, really, that we can't get out from under the current issues and spend more time talking about the things that are such a great story.
I suppose over the last 3 or 4 years, what we've actually witnessed is a very divided country. And I don't just mean the United Kingdom. I think I probably mean England and Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland all being divided over different issues, actually. But we've watched that divided country more or less live through a nervous breakdown and come to the end of its tether on a whole series of things. Do you think there's any prospect of the country putting itself back together again? I mean, I think of the high watermark of modern Britain as being the 2012 Olympics, which was an absolute triumph of the spirit of London. And I mean, it was an amazing place to be, fantastic atmosphere, and of course, great success, both as an event and for the British team, even actually similarly in Rio. And sporting metaphors aren't necessarily the only way of thinking about this, but I somehow wonder if it's possible for either the United Kingdom or whatever is left of it after what we might see in the next couple of years, ever to recover that. Do you think that's possible?
I think it has to be the case that when you think how far we've come since 2012, which was an extraordinary moment, and like many people, you know, we went to the Olympics, we experienced that, and it was extraordinary. If you think how far it feels like we've come in terms of national sentiment since then, I think you have to believe that the reverse must be possible too. And, you know, you and I were both working through the financial crisis, 2008, 2009, which had very profound impacts on us and the people around us at that time. And yet, as you say, by 2015, it felt like the economy was sort of starting to properly recover from that. And we were looking forward to stronger growth and consistent growth. So, you know, we've both been around quite a long time. We've seen cycles come and go. Nothing as profound as this in our lifetime. And yet, you know, looking back to our parents' generation, I just went to sit in my parents' garden over Easter, and they're both in their late 80s now. And they have seen, you know, extraordinary calamities more like what we're experiencing now. And the country did bounce back. And I think you have to hope that in the government's vision of a global Britain facing outwards into the world, engaging more actively across a range of issues, not least trade, from our point of view, you have to be optimistic that that offers some hope of Britain once again finding its confidence in a different way. I'm very hopeful that that can be the case. It's clearly very difficult for them to make that vision real at the moment when they're dealing with such a terrible day-to-day crisis.
So just in the last few minutes we have together, tell us a little bit about the job that you're going to. First of all, tell us what the AHDV does and what you're going to be doing there.
The Agriculture and Horticulture Development Board was established by statute in 2008 as an amalgamation of a number of historic bodies that were set up to support British agriculture, to make it more efficient and effective, to recognise the fact that a lot of farming is done by very small businesses who could not afford to invest in things like research or marketing, and to provide those services for them, paid for through a statutory levy. So this is funded, I suppose you would liken it to the BBC licence fee. This is a levy which farmers in the sectors that AHDB covers have to pay. The money goes to AHDB, who then spend it on, as I say, marketing and research and spreading best practice. So it's a fascinating organisation in that it has, a bit like FDF, long history, although it's gone through different corporate structures. I described it in my quote in the announcement press release as a critical moment in the organisation's history, because two of the six sectors that AHDB represents have recently voted against the levy. They've triggered a ballot on the levy, and the potatoes and horticulture sector have said no to the levy, and that's something which the government now is going to have to consider how it goes about implementing. So it's an organisation which in a strange way is in quite a similar position to the one FDF was in when we joined in 2015, because at that time, although our organisation is funded by membership subscriptions, some of our big members had signalled that they were no longer willing to support the FDF in its current form. So we came in at a time when change was mandated by our key stakeholders, which is precisely the position that AHDB finds itself in today. And that's why I guess I found it a very attractive proposition to be asked to lead an organisation like that through a period of change. I feel, I guess, emboldened and confident given how far we've brought FDF over that period. And I just hope and believe that I can do something similar at AHDB.
Well, I'm sure that's a prospect that AHDB members and levy payers will be embracing and hoping is absolutely right. What is your, as we exit from this conversation, what is your sort of farewell message to FDF members and those who are interested in the FDF and what it does? What do you want to say to them on this last occasion to address them?
I would say that the last five, nearly 6 years since you arrived and me shortly thereafter have been a really energizing time for this organization, both internally and externally. And as I prepare to leave, and you've now said that you will be leaving at the end of this year, there's clearly a moment of decision for FDF about what its future looks like. I hope that members and our key stakeholders will want the FDF to continue to be that energetic, outward-looking, opinionated organisation that speaks up on behalf of what is, let's face it, Britain's largest manufacturing sector. I don't want the last 5.5 years to have been something of a kind of departure from business as usual. I hope what we have established is going to be business as usual.
Tim, thank you for that. And thank you from me and from the FDF members for the last 5+ years. It's been a complete blast. And it will be very strange to come to work in a week or 10 days time. It'll be strange to come to work, actually, come to think of it. But it'll be strange to come back to work in the summer without you being here. I know you won't be far away. And I should say that, you know, from my point of view, none of what we've achieved would have happened without you. I mean, I was trying to think of a parallel. My sort of easy reach for analogies is usually football or politics. So I'm thinking Clough and Taylor. I'm thinking Morecambe and Wise. I'm thinking Blair and Brown. I just think that FDF members have a huge and probably not quite conscious reason to be unbelievably grateful to you for your impact on their success over the last 5 years and your enduring legacy for the future. And I know they would all want me on their behalf to wish you very, very well in the future, because we know what a great leader you are. And while you won't be here to lead the FDF through the next few years, you will be playing a crucial role in the wider industry. So we wish you all the luck in the world. And as I said on other occasions in another context, you know, there is nothing but love for you around this table and this organisation. And thank you very much.
Wow. Well, thank you, Ian. That's a lovely tribute. I have had such a great time over the last few years working hand in glove with you and this amazing team that we have built together. It has been a blast. And you've always said that working has to be fun. There's got to be, given how much time you spend at work, there's got to be not just satisfaction, but joy at work. And that's the thing I reflect on the most over that period, that even at times of incredibly intense workload and difficult decisions of juggling priorities, that there has been joy here. And I think that's what's powered us. I'm enormously grateful to the members for their support and their challenge and for their stepping up to help FDF achieve what it has achieved. I'm enormously proud that two of my team are stepping up into more senior leadership roles as I depart. That feels like a really significant achievement, actually, more than any of the policy achievements. And I'm really pleased that I'm going to continue to be working in food and drink, which I have discovered is just the most fascinating world. And I'm going to be taking with me, stealing actually, a whole suitcase full of inspiration from you about leadership, which has been a masterclass over the last few years. And armed with that and the amazing case study of FDF, I'm going into my next role full of confidence that we can achieve the same kind of transformation there.
Tim Rycroft, ladies and gentlemen.
Now is the time to say goodbye. 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 We're leaving you, skinny dog. Goodbye. We've had a fun good time.
Thank you for listening to this FDF podcast. FDF is the voice of the food and drink industry, supporting our members with the expertise to develop, grow, and strengthen their business. To learn more about how we can help your business, contact us at members.inquiries@fdf.org.uk. There's no better time to become an FDF member.